From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. We'll begin with the election campaign here in the United States. The candidates for president, Donald Trump, Republican, of course, Joe Biden, a Democrat who was vice president to Barack Obama, they are now actively campaigning, and Election Day is just about 6 weeks away, November 3rd. And then a foreign policy victory, it seems, for President Trump. At the White House, he proudly played host to the Prime Minister of Israel and the foreign ministers of the United Arab Emirates and of Bahrain, as those two Arab nations normalized their relations with what's often called the Jewish state of Israel. We'll analyze what all that means. As usual this year, we'll talk about the latest in the coronavirus crisis. The number of deaths all around the world is around 4,500 per day, and that includes here in the United States about 1,300 per day. COVID-19 is still spreading, but pharmaceutical companies are testing vaccines aimed at preventing it. We'll try to fit in even more, but let's turn to American politics with the help of our experienced British newspaper man who is stationed here, Josh Glancy. First, the big picture. Is it fairly clear that Joe Biden, the Democrat, is ahead of President Trump? Biden has a bigger chance of winning this November, Josh?
Hi, Dan. Yes, it is clear. The polls are pretty unanimous in putting Biden ahead, both in key battleground states and in the national race too, and by a margin that is really too large for there to be an error unless they've really got their polling systems completely way off, completely skewed. But polls are only ever a snapshot of a moment in time. We are still almost 50 days out from the election. So Biden has a healthy lead and quite a stable lead. It's about 7 points nationally. He's about 4 or 5 points ahead in a lot of the key battlegrounds. But that doesn't put Trump out of it. Trump needs a couple of things to break his way. For example, there is the presidential debate coming up in about 10 days. If Trump performed very well or if Biden was faltering during that debate, a lot of people are going to tune in. That might change some views. Or maybe we'll have an October surprise. We know that elections sometimes give us stories and surprising moments in the final stretch. But as it stands, even if there is a shy Trump vote out there, people who are going to vote Trump but haven't said yet, late deciders and that sort of thing, Trump's behind. He knows he's behind. The campaign knows he's behind. He'll need something to break his way over the final stretch.
There is a phrase in American politics, the October surprise, as you said, with the election coming up in November. But, you know, Americans often start voting early. And this year with COVID-19, there are a lot of people in this country who say they don't want to go to the polling places on November 3rd. So they've asked for absentee ballots or in some states, actually paper ballots are mailed to their homes. President Trump says this system of mail-in ballots, probably more numerous than ever in the past, leaves the possibility of fraud, of massive fraud. So, J.J. Green, you specialize in security. You speak to a lot of security agencies and experts. Is there really a lot of concern that our election system, especially this year, might not be secure?
No, not at all. The election system, based on the people that I speak to, is absolutely secure. The problem that they and many other people are worried about are those that are trying to undermine the system. There are lots of instances that I've come across and had conversations with people about those that are trying to physically weaken the integrity of the system. In situations in certain states, in certain voting districts, you have people who have their own thoughts and ideas about who should win and what kinds of policies this nation should follow. And some of those people, unfortunately, according to some of the sources that I've been talking to, are attempting in their own way to try to undermine the system. Now, it probably won't matter on that scale, but there are individuals and there are organizations, some of them foreign, I might add, that are hard at work trying to undermine the integrity of the election system in the U.S., but it is absolutely secure.
Well, would you agree that, for instance, foreign meddlers, it might be the intelligence agencies of foreign countries, Democrats claim that Russia wants President Trump to win. The Trump campaign says China wants Joe Biden to win. But I'm wondering whether foreign intelligence agencies, even if they can't get into the system of how America votes and counts its votes, maybe they can have an impact on all the pre-election campaign, you know, what's on Facebook and other yes. social networks, and affect that.
Yeah, they're trying to get into the heads of voters, not so much into the system, because they know that that's Fort Knox, that's locked down. They're trying to get into the heads of the voters, and they're doing everything they can to support their point of view. If you look at what Congress is battling about now, those election briefings from the intelligence community, there are those that are in the intelligence community that understand that Russia has doubled down on its attempts to try to sway, to swing voters, to pump them full of disinformation. China's doing the same thing. There's Iran, there's North Korea, there are other countries as well. But this thing is really all about right now voters doing their homework, voters being intelligent about the situation and recognizing that the system is safe. What they need to do is to, according to the people that I speak to, is they need to check out thoroughly everything that they're being told and see, everything they see about candidates before they vote.
Well, in this unusual year, there's also the expectation that we won't have the traditional election night with a winner declared on that day, November 3rd, and maybe not even November 4th. And who knows how long it'll take, I guess, largely because so many ballots will be on paper ballots that are mailed in and counting them and legal challenges. Josh, what do you make of that? We shouldn't expect an election night. It could be a week, it could be a month until it's all settled.
Yes, it's a rather daunting prospect, isn't it? I think people are doing a lot of preparing and scenario gaming out scenarios for the worst possible outcome. It's still distinctly possible, particularly as if you look at the current polls, that Joe Biden could win very comfortably, and we might indeed have a result on election night. But everyone feels in their gut that somehow it's going to end up being close and it'll go down to one or two states. As you point out, there is going to be a lot more mail-in voting this time around. And as we've seen with some primary elections, for example, in Pennsylvania, it can take a long time to count these votes. People are able to deliver their mail-in votes almost in many states right up to the election day itself, and even afterwards if they're postmarked correctly. So there is definitely the ingredients here for some confusion and for some contests over mail-in ballots. And it could be a pretty febrile moment because everyone's pinning a lot of hopes on this election. There's a lot of anger on both sides, and you could see people out on the streets if these things are contested, but it doesn't have to be that way. You know, it could also be a smooth result and an easy win for one of the candidates on election night, but definitely preparing for all scenarios at this stage.
Dan, can I say something? 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Several of the U.S. government and private security firms that I've spoken to, and some of the U.S. government officials that I've spoken to, have voiced exactly what Josh is saying. They think that regardless of who wins, there's going to be people out in the streets, regardless of who wins, and they're not going to be happy. So this could be unprecedented in more than one way.
Another controversy that we see on what we call the campaign trail, as President Trump and Joe Biden travel to various states and are really picking up their campaign activity, is how they approach COVID-19. President Trump, in general, does not want to be seen wearing a mask. Joe Biden does want to be seen with a mask covering his mouth and nose. He thinks it sends out the right message. JJ, what have we seen? You know, when there is a televised Trump rally, just to be fair, you look at a crowd, sometimes it's been indoors in Nevada recently, for instance. How many people seem to be wearing masks?
Well, can't really count them all, but I can say the majority of what I've seen appear not to be. The thing that's most important, Dan, is what we do see is horror. Honestly, when you start talking about some of those communities where some of these rallies have been held and in situations where some prominent people have actually fallen victim to it, who've been at these rallies, you also see at some of these rallies people who say that they think it's a hoax. You also see people that say they don't care. It's completely up to those people to make their own decisions, but not getting into the politics of any of this, what you see are situations in communities where people are really, really stressed out about scenarios where people go in public not wearing masks because of what it could do to other people who aren't there who may be vulnerable.
When we ask the Trump campaign or the White House spokeswoman, Kayleigh McEnany, why is it that Trump supporters are not wearing masks and why aren't you insisting or strongly recommending? She says they have the right to choose the freedom of assembly, the freedom of speech. If they don't believe in a mask, we're not going to force them. And just the other day, the Attorney General William Barr said that shutting down businesses in order to combat COVID-19, he said, has been a violation of civil rights, a form of house arrest. Perhaps the worst thing in American history when it comes to civil rights, except for slavery. So Josh Glancy, even the approach to COVID during the campaign has become politicized.
Well, yes, 7 weeks out from an election, nothing is not political at this point. But, you know, one does have to remember that the rationale for lockdowns when they happened was to prevent hospitals being overwhelmed. I mean, that was the key rationale anyway, because they are enormously damaging. And we shouldn't rush into them. And my country, the UK, is pushing back towards lockdown at the moment. But there is a lot of resistance. And we must remember that they do an enormous amount of economic damage and psychological, mental health damage to people. And, you know, it really is a last resort. As Anders Tegnell, Sweden's chief epidemiologist, has said, it's a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. And Sweden has taken a different approach. They haven't used lockdown and their case numbers are now going down. So there are other ways to do this. I can understand people's resistance to lockdown. I'm not sure I'd go as far as the Attorney General. That's somewhat hyperbolic, but it is a very damaging set of responses, and we should shy away from them again if possible, I think.
Well, we want to talk about the Middle East deal that President Trump is taking credit for and a lot more, but that'll be right after our short break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And our moderator, Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday.
Hello again. Last week at the White House, history was made as the foreign ministers of Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates had a friendly get-together on Tuesday with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. President Trump was the host, happy to claim credit for breaking the barrier that had almost all Arab countries rejecting any open contacts with Israel since that country was established in 1948. The exceptions were Egypt, reaching a peace deal with Israel back in 1979, and Jordan in 1994. Now, with Gulf Arabs having open relations with Israel, there's talk of a new Middle East. Josh Glancy, whoever deserves the credit, this was big, and therefore a big change means it's an accomplishment, Josh?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the credit on the American side goes to Jared Kushner, who brokered these deals. You know, time will tell how significant they are. In some ways, they make real what was already happening in the Middle East, which is that relations between Israel and these Gulf countries have been softening for many years. But the idea of flights going from Bahrain to Tel Aviv, potentially even Saudi Arabia, if they choose to join this accord, as suggestions are that they will, that would be pretty momentous. And Israel weaving itself into the Middle Eastern economy, to this kind of globalized Gulf Arab economy, there's a lot of tech work they can do together. There's a lot of things they can sell to each other. This is pretty momentous. It's a big win. It's a win for Israel. It's good news for the Gulf Arab states that they can trade with Israel. It's bad news for Iran, who is in many ways the reason that this deal is being made, is as to form a front against Iran. And it's probably bad news as well if you're Palestinian. It strengthens your enemy, if you like, in Israel. So it's a diplomatic coup, and Trump and Kushner deserve credit for brokering it.
When it comes to the Palestinian angle, if we can put it that way, it is obvious that Israel, certainly the Prime Minister Netanyahu, is enjoying the fact that he can have open relations with Arab countries, doesn't have to make a deal with the Palestinians first. And so you may wonder what the so-called peace camp in Israel is thinking. And as they try to retain some optimism, they say that, oh, okay, maybe together the United States, it might be President Trump, it might be a President Joe Biden next year, might get together with Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries and put pressure on the Palestinians and Israel to return to the bargaining table. That maybe if Israel feels more comfortable and more secure, it would make concessions, and maybe the Palestinians would see that they don't have many choices. Now, J.J. Green, I mean, as a security analyst, what do you make of this Middle East deal? Is it something of a game changer?
It is. But the reason why we have to keep a very close eye on this is, as Josh mentioned, he talked about the time that we're in right now. The ecosystem of world peace is organic, and we know this. You know, leaders change, policies change, time moves on, things that we think are ironclad sometimes turn around, sometimes years, sometimes decades later, and they're not working. They're not so popular, and they can get undermined. It's hopeful that what took place will lead to peace, but we have to understand that the Palestinians need to be a part of this, and I don't believe they're very happy about what's taken place. So we can't underestimate what might happen as a result of them not being a part of this. We hear from the administration that there's something coming for them. I think the president said there's lots more coming, or other deals or something like that. We'll have to wait and see. But at the very least, we, I think, need to really keep our eye on who's running this country, who's running Israel, who's running Bahrain and UAE in terms of whether this will work.
I would say, Dan, as well, is that more peace is always a good thing. You point out that the kind of view of the peace camp in Israel, it's certainly undeniable that the status quo wasn't working. So while this doesn't necessarily deliver anything for the Palestinians, at least it is a change in the status quo. It's conceivable that a different deal might be made in the future, just because the chess pieces have moved around the board. We're getting into a different place, and maybe that'll deliver it. Certainly, things haven't been working historically, so maybe this will deliver something different for everyone. Who knows? That's the optimistic case.
Well, President Trump and his son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, who really focused on the Middle East and on trying to make this deal, they both say that part of the motive is to let the United States pull out of the Middle East. Indeed, there was an announcement that U.S. troop levels in both Iraq and Afghanistan are being reduced. President Trump wanted to do that before the election in this country. He says the U.S. doesn't need oil from the Middle East. So whether it's the U.S. or its NATO allies, Josh, do you see the connection between this Israel, Bahrain, UAE set of agreements and the U.S. pulling out of the Middle East?
Yes, absolutely. Part of the reason the Gulf states came to the table on this was a sense that if they're losing American backing in the neighborhood, in the region, then they need another partner. And the obvious partner is America's very close ally, wealthy, very strong military state, Israel. In a way, it kind of suits America to pull back. That's Trump's view of the world, that America shouldn't be spending too much time and money, particularly in the Middle East, where it's sunk so much blood and treasure historically, and let them get on with it. The region can run itself. And if you have an accord between America's ally, Israel, and the powerful Gulf oil states with their wealth, then that's a kind of front against Iran and against Turkey, and it creates a kind of regional bloc that can run the region. That's the theory of the case anyway, and we'll see. But it's certainly a new approach.
Let's turn our focus back to COVID-19 and the possibility that there will be vaccines. That means people all around the world, billions of people in theory, could get a jab, an injection in their arm, probably a second booster dose about a month later. And then everyone in theory might be immune to COVID-19, even though experts, even at the pharmaceutical company, say it might only be 50% to 70% effective. And JJ, there's the additional challenge. Many Americans might choose not to get the injections. What are you hearing?
I've heard that there are people that are considering that. And of course, there are people that are called the anti-vaxxers that don't like any kind of vaccine. I'd have to wait and see on this. The honest to goodness truth that I've learned from Dr. Anthony Fauci, I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago for my podcast, the Target USA podcast, and he said later this year, perhaps early next year, there will likely be a vaccine, and the most vulnerable and healthcare workers are going to be the first to get it. And it will probably be much later in the year before folks like myself and others, you know, who aren't in any high risk group or in any essential group, will get them. And one of the things that he said is that there are people who are concerned about getting it too soon. So there may be that case where there are those who won't take it under any circumstances, those that are concerned about taking it too soon. But at any rate, I am very confident there's going to be a vaccine at some point. And I think most people will see at some point it is worth it to get it.
Let's consider what's happening in New York City right now, also affected by COVID-19. In September, you normally have a huge gathering of international leaders. It's the annual opening of the United Nations General Assembly. But this year, the big speeches at the UN starting Tuesday will be mostly pre-recorded videos because of COVID-19. All those foreign leaders not coming, that reminds us that tens of millions of tourists and other visitors haven't been coming to the United States. It's almost exactly half a year since almost all Europeans were banned from entering the U.S. Most foreign travel is stopped, business, tourism. Josh, when you think about it, will things ever return to what they used to be when it comes to travel?
And this is a very personal issue for me because I haven't been able to go home and visit my family for 6 months now because I'd be unable to get back into the United States. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I was in Yellowstone Park for my summer holiday recently, and it was lots of tourists there. It was a sudden strange realization that none of the tourists were foreign. There were no, you know, hordes of busloads of Japanese tourists taking lots of photos, and as you traditionally would see. Will things go back to the same? I think they probably will. I mean, it's always in the moment, it feels like the world could never be the same again. But our impulses to travel and to visit and to see other places and go to the General Assembly and have those little sideline conversations with other world leaders, those impulses will remain. The extent of travel we were doing, we've been a little bit humbled by this pandemic, and it's going on such a long time that some of our habits will probably shift a little bit. I certainly feel like I was behaving indulgently the amount I was flying beforehand. So maybe we'll be a little bit humbler in the future.
Humbler, staying at home more. JJ, I mean, right now we're using Skype. An incredible number of people in the world are using Zoom and other ways of getting together while sitting at their own desk or their backyard or whatever. You know, so JJ, maybe even for high-level talks, leaders don't have to get together as much as they used to in person.
No, they don't. But I've been back in the office since June, and I understand exactly what's taking place here. A lot of people can or could have gone back, but they are concerned, and I don't blame them one bit. Because, you know, part of the problem that we face right now is getting past what happens, you know, after you fall, have that terrible fall or break that bone or tear that tendon. And then when you are trying to get back up on your horse and start again, you're fearful of it. And I understand people are concerned about where we are right now and getting back to the normal, but it's going to come because the night can only last when it's night. The sun's going to come out when it's time for the sun to come out and vice versa. So that's one thing that you can count on. The other part of this equation too is if we embrace moving ahead and continuing to move forward within ourselves, then we'll have probably a rosier view. But right now we're seeing a lot of gloom and doom around us and we're hearing it everywhere, but it's going to happen. As Josh said, it's going to happen, but who knows when, though.
And JJ, just briefly, New York City in September usually is a huge security headache with leaders of Russia, Venezuela, sometimes Iran, you know, often over 100 world leaders there. I guess it's true that New York City and the U.S. authorities don't have quite that security headache because of COVID changing the UN General Assembly.
Well, yeah, they don't have that headache. They don't have that physical headache, but you certainly can't say that the virtual headache compares even remotely to the kind of physical problem that people have in trying to make sure that everyone there is physically safe. But there has just been an absolute avalanche of virtual risk that have been taking place. We know that not only are nation states, but there are well-positioned and very capable hacking groups that are stealing everything they can from everyone. Even some of these high-profile organizations that are using virtual methods to communicate, some of the people that are facilitating this are working from home, and that therein are the weak links. So protecting people physically is something that they don't have to worry about, but doing all of this virtually it's ridiculously complicated.
Cybersecurity issues, even as we use and depend on the internet more than ever. That's all the time we have. Our thanks to JJ Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of the podcast Target USA, and to Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the British newspaper The Sunday Times. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Revive.